Thanks so much for being with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. And I should mention, Clara Neipert, by the way, is our producer today, and Maria Lopez, our engineer. Great to have Maria joining in. She hasn't been with us, I don't think, ever, but so it's great, maybe once. But it's nice to have her with us as well as we talk about grief a bit. And thanatology, it's a scientific discipline. It looks at death and dying from many perspectives. Sometimes we think about death, I mean, it can be a downer for people, but I think our guest, Janet McCord, understands that, but she comes to it with a lot of enthusiasm for her field, and it's great to have her on to talk about how a thanatologist sees grief and how to deal with death in our own lives. Janet is director of thanatology, the program at Edgewood College in Madison. Started last fall, as a matter of fact.
Yes, it did.
She's been a thanatologist and suicidologist for nearly 30 years and was previously president of the Association for Death Education and Counseling. On the board today, as a matter of fact, she's a member of the International Work Group on Death, Dying, and Bereavement. So as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in with your questions about the grieving process. What's your opinion about the way our society talks about death? There's a lot of ways to think about that, I believe. I hope you'll join in. You can call us at 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Well, Janet McCord, welcome. It's great to have you with us today.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
We'll pull that microphone a little closer.
To
you. Yeah,
okay.
There
How's
you
that?
Go.
Is that better?
Oh, yeah. Now I hear you really good. So, how do you define grief?
Grief and bereavement are kind of similar people. When we are bereaved, it's because someone or something important in our lives has died. It could be our mother, could be a sibling or a child or a friend. And grief is the process of coping with that loss, coping with bereavement.
So as I understand it, there's intuitive grief.
Mm-hmm.
There's instrumental grief. I've read that. And I'm wondering, what's the difference between the two?
Okay, that's a really great question. And that was the whole continuum between intuitive and instrumental grief was identified by my good friend Ken Doka and his colleague Terry Martin, who died in the last year or so. The whole idea here is that for people that are intuitive grievers, or at that end of the spectrum or that end of the continuum, they tend to be very emotional. They might cry a lot. They might express it, in their hearts or their souls, and their bodies will feel the grief and express that grief, often through tears. On the other end of the spectrum is instrumental. And this can be someone who doesn't cry. That doesn't mean they're not grieving. It just means that they're not particularly emotional about it. And maybe they do things instead. They might go out and chop a tree down,
mm-hmm,
as a way to express that grief or that tension that they feel inside their bodies. Most of us are somewhere between those two.
Yeah, I was thinking about myself. I'm probably a little bit in the middle. I've had, I think in the last 2 months, I've had four friends die, and they were fairly young, middle age, and a couple were, older, and where you might expect or hope people would, if they're going to die, you'd rather have them at least older and have lived a long life.
Right.
And there were some differences, I think, in how I was affected, but also by how the people at the funerals that I attended all of them, how they were affected.
And that can be a factor of what your relationship was with that person. Okay, because grief is linked to our relationships with the deceased. It has to do with what Bowlby years ago called attachment. And so when a child dies, you'll see people much more on the intuitive side of things. But if it's your neighbor down the road, that might not be such an emotional thing for you, even though you knew that person pretty well. So, you know, so it is an individual place on that continuum, but that place on the continuum is going to shift depending on what our relationship was with the person who's died. It can also be linked with the mode of death. Was it a sudden death? Was it violent? Okay. Was it after a protracted and long illness? Was it relatively peaceful? Was it expected or unexpected? All of those things have an impact on how people grieve.
I would think, and there are times when people have gone through a long illness and maybe had caretakers. I had a caretaker one time say that she felt relief, but at the same time felt bad about feeling relief.
Right. And what I would say to that person is don't beat yourself up over feeling relief. Especially after such a long and protracted illness. Oftentimes when people have died after having struggled for many years with a dementia, caregivers and family members might feel a sense of relief, you know? And it's an emotion, and it's a natural one. I don't think it's necessarily a negative emotion. You know, especially if they can name it. Otherwise, they might feel guilty for the rest of their lives. Just name it.
So somebody's just wondering here, an emailer wondering about thanatology and what kind of a program do you have at Edgewood?
We have a master's degree. It's a Master of Science program in thanatology. And it's, in a way, it's designed to help people learn how to help other people in grief, in the dying process. And the students that are coming to a program like this are often people that want to get into a situation, an employment situation, where they're helping grievers. And that might be for a hospice. If a hospice takes Medicare, they are required to offer 13 months of grief support to the families. But Medicare doesn't tell them who to hire. So this kind of a program can prepare someone, even if they have a social work degree, even if they have some other kind of degree, can help them to understand how grief works, how the dying process works, and how to develop programs of grief support for grievers. Most grievers don't need a therapist. So a professional that can offer this grief support without calling it therapy, without being a licensed clinician, can be very helpful. And so I see people from the funeral industry come to a program like this, social workers, some licensed clinicians, medical caregivers, nurses, physicians, those who recognize that they don't know enough. You know, they might have a really solid knowledge of the clinical aspects of dying, but they might not know much about the human response.
Kelly in Northeast Iowa emailed us, says, thank you for having this conversation today. They dealt with the horrible situation of losing a child 7 years ago, and I can relate to that for sure. Our society is very bad at grief, and people need to take the time to learn more about the grieving process and extend compassion with no timeline. Although no one wants to talk about it, Kelly strongly encourages all parents to add their children to their own life insurance policy, usually at low cost, less than $20 a year, and trying to figure out how to pay for a funeral after the devastation of losing a child is something no one should face.
Losing a child is something that no one should face. Kelly, I am so sorry for your loss. It's a terrible, terrible thing when a child dies. And you're absolutely right. Life insurance can be helpful, and no timeline. That's super helpful. You know, years ago, one of my good colleagues, Bill Warden, he's now 90, and he talked publicly about how probably 20 or 30 years ago, some reporter or someone writing an article about how long does grief take, asked him and a few other thanatologists that were gathered at a conference, and, well, how long does it take? And one of them said, oh, about 12 months. And the rest of them said, well, yeah, okay, that sounds about right, except there's no science behind that. I think grief lasts the rest of our lives.
Yeah?
Yes. To one degree or another, it will last the rest of our lives. What's important is to remember is that we often go in and out of grief. There's actually a grief model called the dual process model that suggests that it's exhausting to be in a grief state for long periods of time. And so people often will come out of that and attend to business, and then they'll go back into grief. And as time goes on, those vacillations shift. As someone begins to think about their world of meaning and reconstruct what life looks like without that person in it. That's often the case. It certainly is the case with parents who have a child die. You have to figure out how to go on, how to navigate the world without your child.
Yeah, my daughter died on April 2nd, 21 years ago.
Wow.
And I can still tear up.
Sure.
But you're right. I think you kind of go in and out. I mean, I think about her pretty much every day. Mm-hmm. At some point for longer sometimes, but oftentimes just something will remind me of Lauren.
Sure. And sometimes people will light a candle on the birthday, mm-hmm. or the anniversary of the death, or they'll light a special candle at a holiday to remember the person who has died.
We are talking today with Janet McCord, Director of Thanatology at Edgewood College in Madison, and we're taking a look at grief, and I hope you'll join in. We've got Dennis in Two Rivers and Rick in the Appleton area both waiting. I hope you guys can hang in there because we need to take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us. But I know Dennis and Rick have some things to share, and I hope you'll do that. You may have something to share as well, and I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Janet McCord. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Our guest today is Janet McCord, and we're talking with Janet about living with grief after the death of a friend or a family member. Janet is director of the Thanatology program at Edgewood College in Madison. She's been a thanatologist and suicidologist for nearly 30 years. And so as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And we're having a little headphone problem, so we're having some trouble. We may have some trouble hearing the calls, but you know what? We're going to give it a shot because I really want to hear from what you have to say. Let's go to Dennis in Two Rivers first. Dennis, what's on your mind?
Two months of each other, and I had some help from a grief counselor going through anticipatory grief, and after they both died, I went through maybe 6 months of taking care of their estates, and I didn't have much trouble, so it seemed like, well, maybe I prepared for it during anticipatory grief, but After I finished up with all their estate stuff, it hit me big time. And for 2 years after that, I went through the whole cycle again near the anniversaries of their death, where I went through the anticipatory grief and then the grieving, and it just cycled over again.
Wow. So Dennis's parents were in hospice care. He anticipated grief, but it didn't hit him until much later after they had passed. And then he went through a very tough time for a couple of years. Is that common?
It's very common. The thing about grief is that we all do it differently. And what happens for one person is not necessarily what's going to happen for another person. We're all individuals. And Dennis, I'm sorry that this happened in this way, and especially when you anticipated a heavier experience of grief earlier on. But I think that part of it is that if your parents were both in hospice, I don't think it's unusual at all for there to be a waiting period, if you will, a time lapse before the reality of the death of our parent hits us. And I'm, you know, and that can make it really surprising, and it can make it really disconcerting.
Yeah, thank you very much for sharing that, Dennis. Appreciate it. Rick at Appleton, the Appleton area, has a comment. Rick, hi.
Hello, Larry and Janet. Great subject. Thank you for having the program. I also had both parents pass away. Both I stayed with them at home with the help of hospice care within the last 5 years, and also an older sister. And I just mostly wanted to say hats off to the hospice people, just amazing people doing amazing work. And but more importantly, I guess, or my main comment is that as a child, I grew up and I was kind of an outdoors kid who had done a lot of hunting and took a lot of ecology and biology classes. And to me, it was pretty obvious that when something died, it just died and that was it. And I didn't have any problem with that. My father did. He was devout Lutheran. And I heard about that quite a bit over the years. But more importantly, as I kind of hit middle age, I started having, I guess, what people call paranormal experiences, some of which were pretty concrete. And I was still a real skeptic and still am in many ways. But I think what changes, or what changed for me anyway, was having had those experiences is the afterlife became so much more real. And my reaction to it is still one of like, are you kidding me? You know, this is possible. I guess I just wanted to say that I think if you have the benefit of having positive paranormal type experiences and you actually see that there's an afterlife, or you have evidence of it, I guess at least, is that it really seemed to change how I look at death and dying. And really impacted, I think, how I grieve.
Hmm. Well, here's Rick, who did not believe in an afterlife, and then had some spiritual, paranormal, almost kinds of events that sort of changed how he looks, and you know, he believes there's a spirit, perhaps, of life after death.
Rick, you know, we actually have a model of grief in thanatology that accounts for that. It's called continuing bonds. That some people feel as though they encounter the presence of the person who has died long after the death. And it might be in something as simple as pennies that turn up in significant places, or a feeling that they're getting a presence of someone who has come, who, and you know who they are. I have a friend whose mother-in-law died a few years ago, and as she was dying, it was near a window, and there was a bird feeder outside the window, and goldfinches were coming to the feeder. And after his mother-in-law died, in their home, they experienced goldfinches coming on a regular basis. I believe that this isn't all there is to life. And I think that people do have those experiences, and I think they have them with some frequency.
Rick, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Paul in Madison has something for us. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Janet. I'm glad you're doing the show. It's awesome. My wife passed away 4 years ago, suddenly, after only 19 days in the hospital. And we never saw it coming. There was no forewarnings or anything else. And so at 65, all of a sudden, she checked in, and it got worse and worse every day. And make a long story short, that's all she lived. She never got out of the hospital after 19 days. And so I went through my own grieving process, and I retired, and I took a trip, and I stayed off the highways, and I was living in Colorado at the time, and got back to Colorado, and was overwhelmed by all things Ruth in the house, and then my kids were imposing, and so I went to see a counselor, and I told her my story, and she goes, "You're doing great. You should write a book." I said, "Well, thanks, but I don't feel like I'm doing great." She says, "No." She said, "You're doing awesome." And she said, "There are so few resources for men out there written by men that," she said, "you really should write a book." So I did. So my book is entitled 19 Days, One Man's Guide Through Grief. And I've got a website with called 20daysandbeyond.com. And there's free things on there. There are free, I understand, Janet, what you said, and agree completely that not everybody goes through that grief process in the same way, but sometimes you want that tool to hang on to. And so I provided a couple of those tools. All the proceeds from my book go to a scholarship fund that I established in Ruth's honor at the college that we worked at. So I'm not here to make money on anything. I'm just here to try and help people find a way to have something to hang on to.
Oh, well, Paul, this is... this is really touching, and thank you very much for calling. Janet, I'm not sure if you were able to hear.
I heard a lot of it. As I'm, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like Paul's wife died, in the hospital a short period of time.
Yeah.
And he was encouraged to write a book, and now has this website. Is that, did mm-hmm. I get it? Okay. Paul, I apologize. I don't, my headphones are not working, so I can't hear anything directly. But, sharing stories are so important. They're so important. And lots of people do write their books, or they set up their websites, or they set up, like a blog that people can go back to. And your sharing your story may very well help someone else who's struggling. And so I commend you for that. Thank you for sharing that.
Paul, what's the title of your book again?
19 Days, One Man's Journey Through Grief. And Janet, I do get regular emails from people. They can contact me on the website, but they reach out. I had one that reached out about 2 months ago, and he said, "My wife died suddenly 6 weeks ago. I was absolutely, completely lost until... somebody gave me a copy of your book. I can't thank you enough for putting your story out there."
Oh, that is great. Paul, thank mm-hmm. you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate your call. Nice to know. Nancy in Grafton, we'll go to you. Hi, Nancy.
Well, good morning. Oh, heck, it's afternoon. Anyway, when I was 14 years old, I wanted to go with my folks up to Wausau to go shopping for Christmas. It was a week before Christmas. And gosh, my mother said, "No," she says, "I want you to stay home and take care of the kids," because I was 14 and our baby, I was the oldest of 6 and our baby was 3. So, of course, I was pretty darn mad at her. And anyhow, nobody came home. It was a Saturday afternoon, and nobody came home for milking. And my brother Marvin and I, we were milking cows because, gosh, they weren't home yet. And then somebody drove in our long, long driveway at our farm, and it was our priest, and he said there was an accident. I said, "Anybody hurt?" "Well, your dad's in the hospital." I said, "What about Mama?" "She's in heaven." Well, then the next day, I had to go with my uncle because I was the oldest one. And we went to the funeral home. I had to pick out my mother's casket, her clothes, and I said, on a farm you don't have flowers, but I said, she's going to have a corsage, and she had a corsage. And then I had to go to Wausau to go see my dad, and he's in the hospital all bleeding, you know, because it was my husband who at that time was 18 years old, and he was it happened right in front of his dad's tavern, and he saw the accident happen, and he saw my dad out there, and my dad was all bleeding, and my dad says, "Where's Virginia? Where's Virginia?" Well, there were no seatbelts at that time, of course, and so Bob looked, and he saw a bundle underneath a flatbed truck in front of the tavern, and he climbed underneath that truck, and he picked up that bundle, which was my mother, and he carried her into the little dance hall, and she died in his arms.
Well, Nancy, that is quite a story. Here we have Nancy's mother being killed by a drunk driver while her husband, while her dad was wound up in the hospital, and her as a 14-year-old had to be responsible for setting up the funeral and everything for her mother.
Oh, Nancy, I'm so sorry you had to go through that. At age 14.
Yeah, at age 14.
Oh, that's horrible.
Is there when you're 14 years old or when you're a young person and something like that happens, what's the grief? I mean, what's the typically happens?
What typically happens with
nothing? Well, typically happens.
Nothing typically happens. It's again, it's such an individual thing. But for a 14-year-old to have to cope with setting up her mother's funeral while dad is in the hospital, did the dad recover? Did your dad recover, Nancy?
Oh yes, my dad recovered, and then I'll tell you about almost five and a half years ago, my husband Bob, he was the guy that got my mother, and then Bob and I got married, and we had 14 kids actually, and then he was in the hospital about 5.5 years ago, and he had cancer, and he was really sedated, and somebody's with him all the time, and all of a sudden, he opened up his eyes, and Bob looked up at the ceiling, and he said, "Virginia!" It was my mother, and then he died.
That's not uncommon at all.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So he saw Virginia?
Sure. Could have. Very, very well could have. These are not stories that are super well documented, but I've heard many. Just personally, me. But people will have dreams, or they just have these experiences that other people witness while they're there with them.
Nancy, thank you for sharing your stories. Appreciate it very much. I want to give Martina a chance to join in from Kashina. Martina, thank you for calling.
Thank you, Larry, and thank you for having this show. I feel like everybody can relate. I lost my husband to suicide in October of last year. I have been reading materials and, trying to understand the grief. And some materials I've read talk about suicide grief as being different than a normal grief, which, saying everybody's different. And I experienced my father passing away from illness when I was 20 years old, 21. So I just like to find out if there's any, if there's any specific suicide resources that people can look to. Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling.
Martina, I'm so sorry about your husband?
Yes.
And how long ago did this happen?
October.
That's really fresh. That's really, really recent, Martina. And yes, it depends on who you read in terms of the research literature. In many respects, grief after suicide isn't any different, but in a qualitative way, it's hugely different than grief after other kinds of death. And a lot of that is because of the stigma that society links to suicide, and that other people probably haven't known how to talk to you. So I know suicide death survivors, people grieving after a suicide, will go to the grocery store, and their neighbors will see them, and they won't know what to say, so they'll turn around and go the other way just to avoid any conversation. Martina, I hope that you are finding some support systems for you.
Yes, I've been very fortunate.
Yeah, it's good that you've been fortunate to find resources.
I'm glad you're finding resources, because this is a very difficult road to walk.
As a matter of fact, let's talk for a minute about, I'm sure you are have available resources that people, or you can suggest resources, let's put it that way, that people might turn to.
Yes, there are lots and lots of resources. And for people that have died by suicide, there are lots of different places where you can find resources, including an organization in Minnesota called save.org, so SAVE.org, where you can find resources, also from the American Association of Suicidology and also from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Those three sites offer listings, so you can enter your zip code or you can enter the city where you are so that you can find resources. Unfortunately, sometimes resources come and go. And once they're on a list, they end up staying there for a very long time, because if the support group is disbanded, whoever disbanded that support group might not have gone back to all the places where it was listed. But that would be, those would be some resources for suicide loss survival.
What about pets? Sherry in Oshkosh, she thinks the death of a pet can be devastating for for people.
Yes.
And, you know, others might say, well, it's just an animal. But what do you think of that?
Oh, I think absolutely that the death of our companion animals can hit us much harder than the death of a person. And again, this is because how we grieve is linked to our attachment. Our pets love us unconditionally, especially dogs. You know,
yeah.
They don't get annoyed with us if we fail to do the dishes. You know, their love for us is pure, and our love for them is the same way. And so when our companion animals die, it can hit us very, very hard.
Yeah. Well, John in Hubertus emailed. He said he was with his dad at his death when he died, and he spoke to his last breath. He kept talking, his dad, and the last thing he said was he didn't know which way to go.
That's funny.
Oh, my goodness me. Well, what are some, are there other resources, general resources you can recommend? And we'll put those, we'll put them up on my page.
Okay. Well, there's the Hospice Foundation of America. That's hospicefoundation.org, has lots of resources, whether or not you join. the Association for Death Education and Counseling has a number of free resources, with some webinars that we did, especially during during COVID. For families who have had a child die, the Compassionate Friends is a wonderful organization, compassionatefriends.org. For children who are struggling with the death in the family, if you need to find a resources for your child, then you go to Dougie.org, D-O-U-G-Y.org. The Dougie Center is the gold standard for grief support for children, families, and teens in Portland. It's been in business for at least 30 years, and they have an up-to-date listing nationally of places where families can go. And usually these do not cost a dime.
Well, this is all great information. We'll put those, Claire is going to put those up on our Facebook page, ideas at WPR.org/Larry, and go to today's date. And under program notes, you're going to find that information.
And I just want to say, Larry, to anyone who's grieving, that They need to be kind to themselves.
Yeah.
They need to eat. They need to avoid alcohol, to stay hydrated, to get some exercise, and to know that it's okay to cry, but it's also okay not to.
Janet McCord, Director of Thanatology at Edgewood College in Madison. Great to have her with us. Maybe we get her back and talk again. And just looking ahead to tomorrow, it's our sports show, so we'll be looking at the history of the Super Bowl and talk about a weightlifting record as well. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.